Good afternoon, everyone. We're taping this afternoon's presentation, so we're going to use a microphone. And later, when there's an opportunity for questions, we'll ask you to indicate that you have one, and we'll bring the microphone to you so that when this is played on the website or in other places it's played, people will hear your question as well. That being said, I'd also like to ask you to check your cell phones and make sure that they're off or in the sleep mode so that we don't have rings in the middle of our presentation. Thank you. I'm Josie Parker. I'm the director of the library system in Ann Arbor, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to Trevorwood on a gorgeous fall afternoon. Even though there is a Go Blue afternoon going on, we still have quite a crowd. This is wonderful. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about this project. I'm going to let librarians from the library who are responsible for this great work do that. But I am going to say that I remember when we first had a conversation about the Signal of Liberty about 3 years ago and how excited we all were at the library to be a part of this and to have the possibility at the public library in Ann Arbor to bring this in, get it digitized, organized, and now available to the world. And we have a lot of partners, and I'm going to let Amy Cantu and Andrew McLaren recognize those partners. I think they'll do a better job of that than I am. But I'm going to recognize Amy and Andrew. I'm going to embarrass you both. It's not on purpose, but it is a tremendous pleasure for many reasons. The community is the big one, because there's a library system with amazing support that we have. It's pretty unusual. And right now, with the economic situation sweeping the country, it is very unusual. And I'm very grateful to you for supporting the library in all the ways that you do. But without you and your support, we would not be able to have the people working at the library who are working at the library with the skills and the interest and the energy that they bring. And it's a very interesting place in Ann Arbor as a community, and it attracts really interesting people. And two of them are working here today and are responsible for bringing this to you. And they are Andrew McLaren and Amy Cantu, librarians at Ann Arbor District Library.
Thanks, Josie, and thanks again to everybody for coming out today. I'm just going to take a moment to be sure to acknowledge some of the partners, people that we work with who help with this project. And then Andrew will be giving a demonstration of the Signal of Liberty site for a few minutes, followed by a presentation by Carol Moore. First of all, I'd like to thank the folks at the Bentley Historical Library, Karen Jania, and Bill Wallach and Francis Bruin. Again, as Josie mentioned, we had these conversations 2 years ago, and we're really happy to see this finally get off the ground. The Digital Library Production Services at the University of Michigan, John Weiss and John Wilkins. And we'd like to thank Carol Mull. In the past few weeks, she's been very helpful in helping us get this project off the line, identify some photographs, and write the introduction. I'd also like to mention before we get started that the African American Cultural and Historical Museum is having a related Journey to Freedom tour tomorrow. It's at 2 o'clock. It runs from 2 to 5, and we have handouts here on the table if you'd like to take one at the end of the day. I believe they still have room. It's from 2 to 5 p.m. It's $15, and I hope that we may have Deborah Meadows here. I think she's there she is. Oh, great. Okay. She's going to tell you just a little bit more about it so that she'll give you the accurate information. We also have evaluation forms if you would take a moment to fill them out at the end. With that, I'd like to introduce Karen Jania to say a couple of words on behalf of her.
Thanks. I just have a couple words to say. It's been a real pleasure working with Amy and Andrew. They've been just incredible. The DLPS for putting this all together, but ultimately it was Amy's perseverance that really got this up and running, and I just want to thank Amy a whole bunch for this.
And Deborah, would you like to just tell us a little bit about the tour? Can you come up?
Sure. Me? Real briefly, this is a great opportunity to visualize some of the areas in Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti. that are associated with Underground Railroad, specifically the Beckley Homes on Pioneer Trail. And as was mentioned earlier, it will be a 3-hour tour from 2 to 5. Pick up and drop off is at Washtenaw Community College. Tickets are $15. I won't have you on the bus for 3 hours straight. We'll get off at Carytown and walk around and so you have a chance to stretch your legs a few. But there's a rich history in this area, and so I welcome each and every one of you who would like to take part.
And now Andrew McFerrin is going to go over the site, how to browse and search briefly with you. And
hi, everybody. Some of this is going to look very familiar to those of you who have seen some of our other online projects. You've seen the Ann Arbor City Council minutes or our Personalities Meetings project. Much of this is built on the same system, so it's all going to look very familiar to you. This is the site as you get to it, signalofliberty.aadl.org. Carol Mull has very graciously written an introduction for us for those who may not be familiar with the Signal of Liberty. I'm just going to show you a little bit about how you can browse the Signal of Liberty, how you can search the Signal of Liberty, and what it's going to look like for everybody. The Signal of Liberty was only published for about 8 years. You can see that all of the issues right here was published, it was weekly. It was published, it was almost always 4 pages. Let me hop into one of these here. I'll grab one from 1842 here. So you can see when you go in at this level, you can see all of the articles in paper listed there. And we'll select this one here. This one's kind of interesting. When you get to this level, you can see that you have a large image of the article itself. And over on the right, you have the full page image here, which I'll show you in a moment. This one I particularly like because of this right here. The Signal of Liberty was a struggling newspaper. You could bring in a cord of wood and they would give you a subscription for free. It's just the nature of running a newspaper in the 1840s. And maybe not so different today, actually. If we go to search the Signal, I'm gonna do a search for Crossway here. You're gonna learn a little bit more about Adam Crossway, the Crossway case, when Carol is talking a little bit here. Let's go into this one right here. You can see a big, beautiful, we got some beautiful color images of these. We had the original papers sent out, and they really brought us back some beautiful images that allowed us to get some really wonderful text out of them when they were scanned and the computer read them. If you're on this level here, if you click on this image right here in the box, you're going to get the full page image, a little bit larger than it was there. Again, these are very large images, so they take a couple minutes. And now you can see how big they are. Those images are enormous images, and hopefully anything you're looking for, you can even see in this one. You can see the burn through from the ink on the other side of the paper. So these are all very beautiful. They're very evocative images. And if we go back up, let me go back up to the issue earlier. So you can see that you can jump back and forth through the articles. You can go to the next paper here if you wish. You can go to the previous paper. And there are also PDF versions. Any of this out there, again, on very large files, but there are PDF versions of everything, so you can get another version of it to have, and hopefully this provides a level of accessibility for everything that anybody can look at this on any of their computers. This is taking a little longer than I expected to, but again, it's an update, so that's sort of the way it is.
And if I just add, if people want to see the originals, they are at the Bellevue Historical Library. That's where all these came from. So if you don't want to wait for
so if you don't want to wait for this, you can go to the archives. But if you are willing to wait for this, you can see that these images are as big as you could ever wish for. You know, you can get the level of detail that you can get here. You can see the grain of the paper. And that's what we were really going for. We really wanted to give people as much of the experience of seeing it in the original as we could, but at the same time make it very searchable so that people didn't have to, you know, peruse the volumes and volumes, which Carol will probably tell you what that's like. The other thing we've included here is we've included just a very small set of images connected to the Signal of Liberty. Largely it's small because believe it or not, the photographic record of the 1840s, and that was a bit scant. Exactly. And we've also included an additional resources page, just some links to the Michigan Freedom Trail and some various other articles that have been written about the Underground Railroad and about the resistance to slavery movement in Michigan that hopefully will help people learn a little bit more about what the Signal of Liberty is all about and help them get some context for it. So I'm going to turn things back over to Amy Liu, and she will introduce Carol for me.
Okay. I just would like to give a brief introduction for Carol. We're very happy to have her here today. As a researcher and historic preservation consultant, Carol was involved in numerous Underground Railroad projects as well as museum work. She graduated with a master's degree in historic preservation from EMU in 1998 and was appointed by Governors Engler and Granholm to the Michigan Freedom Trail Commission, where she serves as the chairperson of the Site Identification and Preservation Committee. Carol is also the scholar in residence of the African American Cultural and Historical Museum and serves on several preservation boards. She's currently working as a curatorial consultant of Kemp House Museum in Ann Arbor. She teaches and lectures on the Underground Railroad, and she's written a book titled Unshackled, the Underground Railroad in Michigan, which is due to be published in spring of 2010. Please welcome Carol Maul. Thank you very much, Amy. Oh, thank you. I was thinking, how do I get my slides up? Okay. I'm going to just hit that book for me. So welcome, everybody. I'm very glad to see a nice crowd here. I'd also like to thank, first of all, the University of Michigan football team for blowing out the competition so that you could come here and not feel guilty at all about missing the game. But most of all, I'd like to thank the Ann Arbor District Library and the Bentley Historical Library for putting this online. As was said earlier, I did write a book, and it took me 4 years to research what I needed to complete the book on the history of the Underground Railroad in the state of Michigan, mostly because I had to go through the Signal of Liberty issues one by one on microfilm, like this, trying to, you could see from the quality of some of it, which they had so greatly improved, I can't believe how difficult it would have been to do it on microfilm with the old copies, and now that I have it, I am so excited. I am just so excited about it. I consider it to be a very rich resource, and I'm going to tell you why I think it is. We're all very busy. It is hard to find time to read something that was published 170 years ago when there are so many other things to read that are current. But I'm going to tell you today why I think it's worth your time. And that is because you're going to find a lot of truths in what was written a very long time ago that apply to your life today. And I think that we all have some misconceptions about some historical facts, and what was published at this time, although slightly biased, because after all, it was an anti-slavery newspaper and did have an agenda, still has truths that I think have been lost throughout history. Also, there were some issues that were of greatest importance then that are still today. And getting a perspective for how they focused and addressed those issues at that time in the 1840s might help us consider and think about the issues today. Certainly, there were racial and ethnic tensions, very important religious conflicts, and definitely political. The other reason to look at the Signal of Liberty newspaper is to find connections, and especially for those of us who live here in Ann Arbor. These are connections that are not only physical, but emotional, because these places that are tied to the publication of the Signal of Liberty exist in our lives still. Some of my preservation friends here today will say not as many as should still be around today, but there are still some, and maybe that's one thing that we'll gain from this, is that those of us who pull these connections out of looking at the Symbol of Liberty will say, wow, that's important to me, and I do want to make sure that stays in our community. And one of the places is this marker that still exists at the original location of the founding of the Michigan Anti-Slavery Society, which was on Huron Street. And this marker is at the location, and you've probably driven past it hundreds of times if you live in Ann Arbor and may not ever have noticed it because it is off to the side a little bit. It's at the driveway of the Ann Arbor News Building. So for those who have driven by and never noticed it, this is now your opportunity to find this place of great importance to us, not only because of this newspaper, but because this is where our state anti-slavery society was founded. I talked about the political issues. Well, politics, it's interesting when you read these articles in the Symbol. I've never been somebody who really liked to read about politics so much. I kind of skipped to the more interesting social issues. And yet, when I looked at these political articles, I was fascinated because they use language you could never get away with today. I mean, they were slandering each other right and left, but it's fun to read. And one of the reasons is that our presidents for this entire time period in the 1840s when the Symbol was published were slaveholders. And yet there were probably more people in the country opposed to slavery than willing to ignore it or in favor of it. And so you can imagine all the conflicts, especially when some of them were elected in unusual ways, just based on the way the political system worked. So it's very interesting to read some of these, the politically oriented articles. But I mean, every issue that came up had some sort of political background to it, political basis, but also in some way was affected by the issue of slavery. So what we find when we look at this newspaper and we start thinking about the differences between then and now is that I think I found that people had a greater willingness to speak out. This is William Lloyd Garrison in Boston, who was quite famous, but of course there were people all over the country who were lecturing, talking, and that willingness was risky at that time. People who first came out to speak against slavery and write about it often had faced terrible repercussions. I mean, the first people to speak out against something which was unpopular at the time, talking about being opposed to slavery was unpopular because people were very afraid to disrupt the Union. They were very concerned with what would happen, eventually did happen, with the states seceding from the Union and tearing apart the nation. And some people just said, let's ignore this issue because it's too volatile, and families weren't speaking to each other, neighbors weren't getting along over this same issue. So people who came and lectured about it often faced a lot of hostility. And when you read these articles in the paper, you can imagine these people standing on a platform in public, eggs being thrown at them, tomatoes being thrown on them, and you think what courage it took for people to stand up to their convictions and face people and risk their lives, because in fact there were people killed who were speaking on this issue. And just because I put William Lloyd Garrison up there did not mean that we only had European Americans speaking on the issue or writing about it. In fact, there were many African Americans who took a very strong stand and spoke publicly and wrote publicly, and I think that was maybe, for me, one of the more surprising elements in reading the Symbol of Liberty newspaper, was how many people were writing, how many black people were writing their own newspapers. I had no idea that, you know, the first African-American newspaper was 1827. This certainly preceded the Symbol of Liberty by many years, And I think that in reading the Sigma, it does help us dispel some myths about African-American participation in the anti-slavery movement, and of course later in the Underground Railroad. They by publishing articles in these newspapers and speaking, they helped with telling people how the slaveholders' arguments were false, because obviously here were people of color who were highly educated, highly intelligent, sometimes with little education, but highly intelligent, well-read, and well-spoken. And so they were the spokesperson themselves for why slavery was so wrong. Again, these same people formed their own organizations. At first, I thought they were not included in the Michigan Anti-Slavery Society itself. Women were not included. They were encouraged to form their own ladies' societies, even though the first anti-slavery societies in the state of Michigan were founded by women. Soon, the statewide organization was founded, and women were not involved in it. But later on, even though they didn't attend those meetings, they did have a voice in the ladies' meetings, and they had a good effect. They raised a lot of money for causes. They helped found schools. Unfortunately, their minutes from their meetings were not published in the Civil Liberty the way the minutes of the African American organization were published, and the statewide anti-slavery society minutes. So reading these minutes is very interesting. You might think, oh, reading the minutes of a meeting, how can that be interesting? But it is, if you read them over time, to see how they changed their stance. And initially, people were just maybe opposed to slavery, but they really were not that strongly in favor of abolishing slavery. But as we go through the years this newspaper is published, by the end of it, you see that people were very much ready to take on the mantle of saying we want it abolished. And so the language becomes stronger, and you see how this newspaper was able to persuade many people to come to their way of thinking, and it was highly effective. So here is our Sigma of Liberty. I just want to give some facts about it. It was started, not the Sigma of Liberty, the first anti-slavery newspaper in the state of Michigan was published in Jackson, and it was started by the Michigan State Anti-Slavery Society. One of the things that came out of that very first meeting in Ann Arbor was, we think that we should have a newspaper, because that's the way to persuade people about the wrongs of slavery. So we'll publish and get people to come on board, and then we'll get more societies. And the more societies we have, the more powerful we'll become. And so it was about those two things, the newspaper and then the societies. So the newspaper first was started in Jackson. The Sullivan brothers were asked to head it. It was really Nicholas Sullivan, first of all, but he came out and brought a printing press with him to do it. But it was very, very expensive to run a printing press, to find somebody who knew how to run a printing press, and to get subscriptions. There weren't many people living in the state at that time. And you think about just distributing the newspaper on a regular basis and how costly it was just to not only get money from people, because money was also scarce in those days. There were a lot of banking issues, and so getting the financial support meant that this newspaper, the first one, did not succeed. So then they said, okay, we're going to find someone new, and they came up with Theodore Foster. And then his partner, who had moved to, Theodore Foster was one of the first settlers in this area, and Guy Beckman didn't come until several years later. But they said they would publish the newspaper, and they chose Ann Arbor as the site for publication. And the place that they chose is on Broadway Street. And the building is gone now, but after you cross the Huron River and you cross the Broadway bridges, you can see that the block of buildings there that is the exchange block where the St. Vincent de Paul shop is. That's opposite what where this building was, the Huron block. And the Huron block had a store on the lower level, and that belonged to Josiah Beckley. And then above it was the printing office, and that was where Guy Beckley, Reverend Guy Beckley, and Theodore Foster published the paper. So you see all of these places that link us to this history. I mean, you know, I go by these places and I just feel the history just because I know about it now. So what are we going to find when we look at this newspaper? What did they concentrate on? What did they want to tell us when they published this newspaper? They certainly had an agenda, there certainly are some biases that you'll find in the paper because they were trying to persuade people to oppose the institution of slavery. So they concentrated mostly on politics, national politics especially. After the first year, in the year that they first started publication in Ann Arbor, the anti-slavery movement decided that they needed to go national politically, and they created a national party for elections, the Liberty Party. And the newspaper then became the voice of the Liberty Party. And there were newspapers in every state in the North, and even some in the South, believe it, that supported the Liberty Party. So you're going to have a lot of politics in the newspaper because they were supporting that national party. Then all the anti-slavery societies, you'll find all the minutes from those meetings, and you'll also find how many other minutes there were from other meetings. There were temperance societies, then there were statewide anti-slavery society meetings, but then there were counties that had their meetings, then there were local areas that had their meetings, then they started a young man's society for the youth in the community, and it just, you can't believe all of these different groups. It was trying to reach every single element of society. And then the other thing you'll find are the stories. Of course, this is what I think most people find most interesting and fascinating, but you do need to have those other stories to put it in context, because the escapes from slavery and the Underground Railroad don't have so much meaning unless you understand why it was necessary to escape from slavery and why people needed help to do that. And that, of course, is the basis of the Underground Railroad. So one of the things that the Civil of Liberty sought to do was to describe what slavery was. If you think about it, there were many Northerners who, by in the 1840s, had been born in New York or New England, some of these states where slavery was not necessarily abolished already, but it was on its way out. And so there really were not very many people enslaved anymore. And perhaps people really did not know what enslavement entailed. They did not understand the brutality of it sometimes, the lawlessness of it. And so that was something that this newspaper could do. It could describe what it meant to be enslaved, not only the loss of freedom, but the loss of, personal happiness, the separation of families, that sort of thing. I think that was something that it hadn't occurred to me before, was how people who maybe have been born in Michigan in the 1830s growing up really did not understand what slavery was. This was a free state, and there was not slavery here at that time. And so it helped interview people who came through escaping from slavery and get their own words to describe what it was. And that helped to persuade other people how wrong it was. So what happened is that Foster and Beckley found that there were people escaping on their own. Most of the self-emancipators in the 18, well, I, we have people as early as the 1820s, but in the 1830s coming through, and by 1840 when they were writing a newspaper, would willingly give some interviews about their escape. Unfortunately for us, looking back, some of them didn't give us any names because you really couldn't give names because the person might be captured then. A couple of them did because they were continuing on to Canada where they knew that they would be safe and could not be returned to slavery. So we do have some interviews, including a man named Robert Cox, who described the reasons that he escaped, which were that he was no longer able to bear listening and watching to his own mother tied and whipped, or his sister, you know, being afflicted with the same kind of treatment. Those sorts of articles were, they did achieve their effect, and in the sense they also upset other people in the community who protested that Foster and Beckley should not have been publishing that sort of material in a newspaper. That was the place for it or whatever. And so they did have some protests in the beginning, nothing violent. They had paint, red paint put on the door of the publishing house, the printing house, and then articles written to them. And they responded, bring it on, we're going to keep our stance, we're not going to back down, we believe in what we're doing is, and believe it's right. So one of the escapes that happened was Caroline Quarles. Guy Beckley wrote in the Sentinel of Liberty, as I said before, when people came through, they would often interview people and write about it. For Caroline Quarles, we know about her escape because the man who helped her escape from St. Louis across at least five states, she went up in Wisconsin and came across, wrote about stopping. And he said that they went all the way across Michigan, and he did not name any of the places where they stayed specifically, except someplace in Climax Prairie. And then he said, and then we were entertained by the editors of the Signal of Liberty. Entertained was the word that they used back then, just when they stayed over and somebody took care of them or whatever. Well, this case of Caroline Quarles, she was one of many, has now taken on a very big life in the state of Michigan, and some undertakings are going on now, and this could end up being a really huge thing for the state. There are people who right now are trying to list the Detroit River as an international heritage site, and they are hoping to have the Detroit River be a place where you can go and have all sorts of interactive ways to learn about this, the escape to freedom and crossing. And they're using the Caroline Quarles story as a basis. And so there are some meetings at the end of this month, and some of us that are here are going to those meetings, and other people in other states have taken this one story. And we are so lucky that of all the places in Michigan where she stayed, the one we absolutely have confirmation of is right here in Ann Arbor, and tied to the Symbol of Liberty. So, anyhow, we don't know exactly where she might have stayed at the Beckley house. I think he was friendly with the sheriff, and so she probably just slept in a nice bedroom. But on the other hand, there were other people who did stay at the Beckley house on different occasions, and people knew about him, so it may be that he had to put people in other places and hide them on occasion. One place, other than his brother Josiah's place, which is just down the road, that exists still today is the schoolhouse that the Beckleys built on Traver Road. And it's very interesting. It was just a little schoolhouse. It's been added onto now. But it has a trap door in the kitchen area, and it goes into this rather large space in the cellar. And I've been to many places that are supposed to be hiding places, and some of them are interesting, and some of them can be explained for many other purposes. This one is interesting because it was a schoolhouse. So why would there have been a need for a cellar with storage when it was just a school that only operated in the daytime? It was just a small school. So it's very interesting. And of course, with the location where it was, sitting up on the hill just over the riverbank and the railroad tracks, and of course the Beckleys and all the Beckley family that lived in Lower Town. There were about five of them that lived there, and they were all opposed to slavery and listed in different articles as attending meetings or whatever. Now, Theodore Foster did not live in Ann Arbor. He lived in Scioto Township, and he had a store there. Grace Shackman here wrote about an article and spoke about his history. He also was on the Underground Railroad and was found to have somebody hiding in his basement at one time. The neighbors were pretty upset about it. He ended up getting, I don't want to say he was kicked out of his church, but he ended up leaving the church shortly thereafter. And it was over this whole issue of him hiding somebody in his house and the children playing in the basement, and this sort of it being something that was acceptable as long as people didn't talk about it. They pretended it wasn't going on, but once the man was exposed, then they had to address it. And obviously not all the neighbors were in favor of it, and so he was discouraged from his activity and left his church, which was a very important part of his life, as it was for most people at this time period. And then shortly thereafter, when Guy Beckley left the newspaper, Foster did as well, and he moved to Lansing. Another person who contributed to the civil liberty, and then he started his own newspaper later in Canada called The Voice of the Fugitive, was Henry Bibb. Henry Bibb is a very interesting man, and his book is a great reading because he escaped several times because he kept getting caught again, but he kept escaping. And it's very entertaining reading, and he was incredibly articulate. When he lectured in this area, he lectured in Saline and Salem and Ann Arbor. The Anti-Slavery Society had him go on their lecturing tour. People who heard him, and there's a great article in the Civil Liberty about listening to him and saying, I think he may be the best orator of our time. Another person who was outside of this area, but on the Underground Railroad, was Nathan Thomas. He wrote that he had at least 1,000 people in the time that he was operating an Underground Railroad station come through his place. Before him was Erastus Hussey and his wife in Battle Creek, and they too said that they had at least 1,000 people during that time. Nathan Thomas, I mentioned him because these names will keep coming up. And so when you're looking at the paper and you see the list of people that attend the meeting, especially look at the list of the people that were on and the executive committee, and then the people who were the agents for the Signal. And when you see the column, agents for the Signal, that means the people who were selling the subscriptions. Now, if you're selling a subscription to the paper, obviously you endorse the paper. And I don't think anybody would hesitate to think that you were opposed to slavery if you were. Well, it turns out that in my research for my book, every time I'd see one of these lists, every single person on there was an Underground Railroad operator, maybe with the exception of one or two, because the agencies changed over the years. So these people are the same people who were officers of the Anti-Slavery Society, agents for the Signal Liberty, selling subscriptions, and very important people in helping people find freedom. I mentioned Jonathan Walker because his story is another one that's in the paper, and he has a connection to Michigan as well. He was a man who was caught in Florida helping people escape and sent to jail, and he was branded with the letters SS on his hand, and the SS was for slave stealer. And I wanted to put this slide up here because it ties in with poetry, which you'll find in most issues of the Civil Liberty, there'll be a poem in the very front page. And Whittier, John Greenwood Whittier, was one of the people who submitted poems, as well as, you know, several women and other local poets that we don't even know sometimes who they were, but they were famous people who wrote poems for the Civil Liberty. And his poem called The Branded Hand was one that appeared. Jonathan Walker later moved to Muskegon, and that's his memorial. He's buried there. And there are many of these connections to Michigan that I had never known existed before. When we get to 1847 was a year when we just had an incredible number of escape stories and attempted kidnapping stories or capture stories. There are several of them. They're fascinating because as you read the Signal of Liberty, you'll find that they start with an announcement, and then you'll read something else where there's a follow-up, and then you start reading the court cases. And some of these go on for years, and they have just different resolutions. And some of them you will not find the resolution in the Signal because it went past the time of publication. The Crosswhite case is one of the more interesting ones, and it's very well covered in the Signal of Liberty. And this happened in Marshall, Michigan, where the kidnappers came up from Kentucky and took Adam, who's pictured there, and his wife and children out of the house and, tried to take them out of the house. They broke down the door and then they were unable to take them because the citizens of Marshall said, "You're not taking them." And so there were many court cases that followed this. And it's very interesting to read the take from the Signal of Liberty and get the behind the scenes sort of like who actually spoke up and who reported this. And it's good reading. So the other case that took place in the same year was the Cass County raid. They call it the Kentucky raid. And this was terrible one where there was violence, where a whole group of men came up from Kentucky and a whole posse, and they planned it in advance. They knew that there were at least two very large settlements of African Americans, both free and self-emancipated, living in Cass and Marion counties, and they planned this attack to go and rescue some of them. And one of the people they were after was Perry Sanford, and he had escaped not many months before the attack came. And these men broke into this area and grabbed people from their beds, and some people resisted. Some were able to run away, but many were tied up, including children, and thrown under wagons. I guess I won't tell you how it ends, and you can read it in the Signal yourself. But it was actually the same kind of story as in the Crosswhite case, where the citizens already had banded together to protect these people. They were especially Quakers in that area, and they had a long history of making an area where these people would be safe, this community, and protecting them. And then when this happened, they made chase and rescued them. Most of the people who had been captured left for Canada immediately. Others stayed on. But it's the same sort of thing where it ended up in long court cases. And the outcome in the end was not so great for the Michigan citizens who helped. So those people that you read about in the Signal of Liberty often not only put their lives on the line to be part of this effort to end slavery, but they put the lives of their families on the line as well, because they sometimes lost everything in these court cases. So what else will you find in the Signal of Liberty? Well, there's some fun stuff too. It's not all politics and sad cases. You'll see a lot of advertisements and notices. one of the things you see often is people writing that they found a cow in their front yard. It seemed to be a standard thing back in the day that cattle would roam. And so when one would get loose in somebody's yard, what would they do? They would just say, well, I'm going to have to send a notice into the paper because I don't know who this animal belongs to. And it's been feeding off my grass, and I wish this person would come and get their cow, or else I'm going to keep it. So it is really funny how often you find these notices that I have, and they'll describe, you know, brown, whatever cattle has been here since this date, and please come and get it, and pay for damages. So there are a lot of funny notices like that. Medical cures, I don't know if you know this, but there was a cure for baldness back in 1840. I don't know what happened to the cure, but it was published back then that it was just a topical cream and it took care of it. And there were so many other things that could be taken care of with all sorts of ointments and drinks and all sorts of things. I don't know if there were the scientific studies attached to them that we have nowadays, but back then, they were some of the biggest advertising source were these cures that you read about. And then there is Soleritas. So probably the only person in the room who can tell us what this is going to be Grace or Susan, right? Do you guys know? Okay, well, there are all these ads at these stores where I think even Josiah Beckley's store where they advertise new shipment of Soleritas. Come now, get your. What is? I never heard of this.
Is it baking soda?
Yes. Awesome. There we go. It takes our impressive librarian.
There's a great children's hotel in Soleritas or Soleritas, however you
yes. want to call it. So what happened is in the old days before they had baking soda the way we do now from salt. They got baking soda from ashes. Now, I'm not even going to go near what the health of that was for a human being, but so that's one of the things. I just gave you a little tip when you see this advertised prominently. That's what it was about. So that's it. Thank you.
Do we want to go ahead and take any questions?
Sure.
This time?
I missed the initial minutes. My name is Thomas. I missed the initial minutes of the presentation. I apologize for that. I'm curious if the longevity of the Signal of Liberty newspaper and other Michigan anti-slavery newspapers extended through the Civil War period, and whether they covered campaign stops in Western Michigan by Abraham Lincoln and other candidates in 1860.
Okay, everybody could hear that, right? The Signal of Liberty ended with the death of Guy Beckley. He was only 46 years old. Something like that. He was in his 40s in 1847, and he really was the financial supporter, I think, with his family of the newspaper. And Foster tried to keep it going, kept it going for another year. By 1848, it was finished. Then the Michigan Anti-Slavery Society tried to start up another newspaper, and they got one going with Erastus Hussey in Battle Creek. And it did not survive for the very same reasons they couldn't keep the others going because of financial difficulties. It was just too expensive. To, although the subscriptions of the Signal of Liberty got up to 1,800, I mean almost 2,000 at one point, so it was heavily subscribed. The problem was people didn't pay, even with wood, for their subscriptions. So that's the answer. That was the only anti-slavery newspaper in Michigan. In other states, their newspapers went for longer periods of time. There were some reports of Lincoln, of course, and anti-slavery news in other newspapers. In fact, there was one of the newspapers in Detroit was considered to be sort of anti-slavery but there was none that was a true anti-slavery paper after the one that succeeded the Signal in the state. Okay, yes?
Do you have any idea what percentage of the black population of Canada is derived from blacks who crossed over during these periods?
No, I don't. And,
small
you know,
or large?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, in writing my book, this was one of the things that I addressed, was because there are a lot of perceptions already that, you know, there was this mass migration of people who had settled in the northern states to Canada after 1850, when the second fugitive slave law was passed. And we know that there was a migration, just, you know, from personal accounts or whatever. But what I found when doing the research in my book was that there were many people who came back not long afterwards. They didn't wait until the Civil War to come back to Michigan. It was surprising to me. But there's no statistical data that anyone can derive, because your census data is on each side of that, 1850 and 1860. So you can't get the information between. And then we have the same problem with trying to get a handle on who was living in Canada from 1860 to 1870, because with the outbreak of the Civil War, so many of the black population in Canada that had come from America wanted to fight and left to fight in the war. So it's I can't get a handle on it, and other people I think have tried, but I don't know. I mean, it's just, when I look at some of the individual cases, there were many people who came, black Americans, well, black Canadians who came to Michigan in the 1840s. I found several, and I don't know whether they were free blacks from New Jersey, Pennsylvania, whatever, or whether they had come, you know, escaped and had at one time been enslaved. The fact is, there were many more free blacks in Canada than I think a lot of people realize. Many came from Virginia when Virginia tightened their laws about education, because there had been many free blacks for a generation or so there who had taken advantage. First, they were, you know, there were some where they were allowed to vote for a certain period of time in some of the states in the East, and that was taken away, and then they attend schools and be educated, and that changed. So some of these laws went back and forth in some of these states, and so when they were tightened and there were more restrictions, people left. And a lot of people left Virginia because they suddenly, in the years before the Civil War, faced a lot more discrimination than they ever had in a lot of them came to them. So they were free. It's tricky. Yes?
I have a question about Reverend Beckley.
Yes.
Is there a biography of him? And the other question that came to mind, was with regard to the First Presbyterian Church. Was he the minister of that church, at that church?
No. Another man was, and I've forgotten, Beach? I think it was Beach. He also was an anti-slavery activist, which is one of the reasons the church was made available. Reverend Beckley was a Methodist Episcopal minister, and he, as I said before, when you read about this in the Signal, you're going to find it fascinating, this whole political versus religious tension that existed, because what happened, Beckley is the case of what was happening all over. He's a perfect example of it, because he was very much opposed to slavery and found that his own church would not deny admission to slaveholders, the Southerners. So a lot of the churches split, not only in the North, but they split from the North to South. So he started embracing the teachings of the Wesleyan Methodist Church, and which began with Reverend Swift in Michigan. Really, there were teachings existed, but the church itself, the formation of the church, really started in two places, New York and Michigan, and Michigan was one of the first places to start that church. Well, Beckley wrote in his newspaper about supporting the Wesleyan Methodist Church, and then, surprise, he couldn't believe he was getting kicked out of his own church. So, yes, so he was not the minister there. Yes.
I have several questions about the slavery catchers.
Yes.
I know there are a lot in the border states, but were there just as many coming through Michigan? Also, when they were here, how were they treated by the people who lived there? Were they very secretive, and then they got the slave and just disappeared?
Oh, slave catchers.
Was there a natural circuit of slavery catchers here?
Okay, I just remembered I didn't answer your other question. There is no biography of that.
Biography.
Yeah, there is not. Good thing. Next book after. Okay. Anyhow, the slave catchers, there were people opposed to, people who, I don't want to say were pro-slavery living in Michigan, but there were people who, we call them anti-abolitionists in Michigan. And there were people who, you know, would write openly about it. But slave catchers or slave hunters, came through. I don't know of any who lived in the state of Michigan. I can't imagine they would ever be able to. Their lives would have been too miserable. And most of them that I know of in the stories that we know of, the Crossway case and some of the others, came out of Kentucky. They were often identified early. Laura Haviland from Adrian, who is probably our most prominent Underground Railroad operator in the state, identified people almost immediately. They would come onto her property in Lenawee County, and she would hear that bit of a southern accent, and they'd try to tell her some story about how they were selling Bibles, or they were representing, one of them that came through told her he was representing an abolitionist newspaper. And she's like, I don't think so. But anyhow, people came through and they were on the lookout for them. But there, I don't know of any who stayed here. And they, one who came through, there was a group that came through, the ones that came to the Kentucky, the Cass County raid, they were from Kentucky. They tried going into Battle Creek first. They were going to make that their area to reconnoiter. And Erastus Hussey saw them and kicked them out of town. So they went back down into Indiana and they made that their headquarters in Indiana. And then when they made the raid in Cass County, they came up from Indiana instead of going across because they had to do that because they couldn't be allowed. So does that answer your question? Okay.
I also wanted to comment that I found the reward money to me for that time seemed to be quite high. And it seemed very much worth their time to try to catch these slaves. And my last comment is, it's interesting, and you can see it in the newspaper, I'm sure, how they describe the slaves, because a lot of them, if they didn't have some kind of a scar or some mark, how do you find this person? And yet they were able to find these slaves. The descriptions were so important when it was published.
I think the reward posters, I think somebody has actually written a book about the reward posters. I think I saw something recently. And they're fascinating. I mean, because they are an original source of information about enslavement and enslaved people. One of the things that I find disturbing is that the fact that they had so many scars and marks. I mean, there's something that's telling in itself. The other thing is how often the descriptions will say a very bright young man, able to read. I mean, all of these things that they say couldn't happen or shouldn't happen, then they publish it themselves in their reward posters. You know, that this person, you know, was highly intelligent, well-mannered, you know, just all these things that they said, oh no, you know, you can't teach people to read. I mean, just they're descriptions were ridiculous, really. But they usually talked about what the person was wearing when they left. Some people I know, did not want to post rewards, but in some states it was required that you could go to jail and be fined if you didn't post a reward when the person you enslaved escaped. So that's why some, and there's some, you'll see some out there that says 25 cents or 10 cents. They had to fulfill the obligation of putting out a reward poster, but they didn't really care. And then some would say things like, you know, you can keep, if you can catch them. So they run the gambit. And yes, there were people who were considered extremely valuable as property, if you will, I put that in quotes. On the other hand, Laura Havlin had a reward poster for her in the South, and I think that for her it was $3,000. So try managing that one. And then some of the other Underground Railroad operators, they had bounties on their heads in the South that were in the thousands. There, she was not the only one. One more question?
Maybe you can clear this up. In the history of the Congregational Church, they often mention that they split from the Presbyterians over slavery. And who was more anti-slavery, the Presbyterians or the Congregationalists?
The Congregationalists were more anti-slavery in most places. But it gets very tricky in the early history of Michigan when you look at the Presbyterian and Congregational churches, because what you often find is that these certain Presbyterian churches would be found and they'd be called First Presbyterian, and then in like parentheses it would say founded in the congregational tradition. So some of them were actually combination churches. For instance, there's an Underground Railroad operator in Reverend Orrin Thompson up in he's up in the northern part, above Detroit, north of Detroit, and he served as the minister in both a Congregational and a Presbyterian church, because they weren't that different based on how they were founded and who founded them and what their principles were. So it's kind of dicey in the beginning.
What was the split in the Ann Arbor?
Almost every split in every church was over the issue of slavery, because generally the ministers were the ones who blocked the progression toward opposing slavery, because they knew it was going to split the church with the southern faction and the northern faction, and they, by their church, they didn't want to see their church split. And so they would say, no, I'm going to stay with the teachings of church, and because they believed they could convince people that, and just persuade people that slavery was wrong, and that they would prevail. And they had that faith, but it was very slow going, that sort of policy. I should mention also, since you asked that question, that a lot of people don't realize that the Quaker faith split just as much as some of the other religions over the issue of slavery. And Laura Havlin, for instance, was raised a Quaker, and she left over the issue of slavery, and she became a Wesleyan Methodist, which is something else. When you see a list of Wesleyan Methodists, you can be sure that most of those people are strong abolitionists and most likely on the Underground Railroad. I won't say that they definitely were, but the Wesleyan Methodists were generally people who left other churches over the issue of slavery. As soon as the slavery issue was settled in the Civil War, the Wesleyan Methodist Church pretty much disbanded in most places.
Did your book cover that? Does your book cover
Yes, that? It does talk about that aspect.
Can we go back to the biography of Reverend Berkeley? Is there a biography?
No.
Have you been able to actually interview the descendant locals or Michigan descendants of slaves?
Yes. In fact, I just got a letter this week from Dr. Benton in Wisconsin, who's descended from Elijah Benton, who lived in Pittsfield Township near Captain John Lowry, who had an Underground Railroad station. And he sent pictures. He has pictures from his family album of the family. In fact, I can let you use the John Lowry picture because he said that I could decide where it was dispersed. So I'm happy to let you use it. So he's very proud of this history. And then there are many descendants that I've met through the African American Cultural and Historical Museum that are from the Array family. Asher Array was a prominent Underground Railroad operator in Saline area on US 12. He was long neglected because the census data had his name listed as Ray, R-A-Y, instead of Array, the A spelling, A-R-A-Y. So people didn't tie it together when they put together the histories, but he was free, and his family goes back to the 1700s free in America. And that's covered very well in my book. Let's see, the other descendants on the Beckleys, there are both African American and European American Beckleys. And one of the descendants sent to the museum, the African American Museum, a hymnal that Guy Beckley wrote, and that's in their possession. No picture of him. So yeah, there are many descendants around, apparently. And then of course the Caroline Quarles, one of her descendants is the person who's behind making this initiative to have this trail be a historic trail. Okay, thank you very much, Caroline.